happy talk, keep talking happy talk. Talk about things you'd like to do.
Welcome all to the Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX 935. My topic tonight is young love. There was a story that I just heard on the news about a young preschool couple who were inseparable as little children, and then one of their families moved away from the little town in Connecticut where they'd grown up. So the tots lost touch. 19 years later, they re-met. They found an old photo of the two of them standing together in a little red toy car with their arms around each other. And in their wedding photo, they recreated that scene in a big red car with a just married sign strung along it. They said we were destined to be together. Were it always so, young love these days might not go as smoothly. The New York Times had a competition where they solicited stories of young love from college students, and I'm going to read you a few of the winning entries. This first from Jordana Naren. She writes about her Jeremy. This is what she tells us. One night my friend Maddie whispered, "My Jeremy is coming to visit this weekend." "You're what?" I asked, thinking I'd misheard her. "My Jeremy," she repeated. "I've told you about him. His name's Will, and we grew up together in Washington. He's visiting from school. He's my Jeremy." And she realized what she meant. The name, Jeremy, had become an all-purpose noun used by her college friends to talk about the guy who remains with us in some netherworld between friend and boyfriend, often for years. Naren writes that she met the original Jeremy at summer camp in the Poconos when she was 14. They'd actually lived only 30 minutes apart back home, but it wasn't until 11th grade that they ran into each other again at a Halloween party, where she was dressed as a rabbit and he as a vampire. She says, as Maroon 5 blasted in the background, he murmured drunkenly into her ear, "I've missed you." "I've missed you too," she murmured back. And under the muted flashes of a strobe light, they shared their first kiss. They stayed in touch for the rest of high school, but mostly by text message. They did also meet up in person when his school's basketball team played her school's and when she ventured from New Jersey into Manhattan for academic events. At the time, she was eager to move on from high school, and talking to Jeremy was an escape, a peek into an alternative universe where shy boys with moppy brown hair and clever minds seemed to care about more than their next hookups. Once, when she'd published an article about her struggle with Crohn's disease in an obscure online magazine, he wrote with praise and told her it moved him, which lessened the shame she'd felt about it. And she found that every time his name popped up on her phone, her heart raced. But they were never more than semi-affiliated, two people who spoke and loved to speak, and kissed and loved to kiss, and connected and were scared of connecting. She told herself it was because they went to different schools, because teenage boys didn't want relationships, because it was all in her head. She said she told herself a lot of things she never told him. And 2 years after their first kiss, they were exchanging "I've missed you" messages again. And on one brisk Friday evening in their first semesters of college, she stepped off a train and into his comfortable arms. He'd texted weeks earlier on Halloween, which was technically their anniversary, to ask if she would visit. They hadn't talked since the summer, and she'd been trying to forget him. They'd graduated from high school into the same inexpressive void they'd first entered in costume, wherein "I've missed you" was as emotive as one got. She'd decided to leave him behind when she left for college, but he wouldn't let her. Whenever she believed he was out of her life, she'd get a text or a Facebook comment that would reel her back in. And she wouldn't let herself move on either. His affection, however sporadic, always loomed like a promise. So she accepted his invitation to come visit her that weekend, asking herself what she had to lose. She says she actually lost a lot that weekend. She lost a bet on the football game. She lost 4 pounds of weight from nerve-driven appetite loss. She lost a pair of underwear, and apparently she lost her innocence. Naively, she'd expected to gain clarity, to finally admit her feelings and ask if he felt the same. But she couldn't confess, couldn't probe. Periodically, she opened her mouth to ask, "What are we doing? Who am I to you?" But he'd stopped her with a smile, a wink, or a handhold, gestures that persuaded her to shut her mouth or risk jeopardizing what they already had.
Fast as you can be, deep the shade of blue. When you're feeling alone, oh, to whom else do you go? See, I'd cry if you hurt, I'd give you my last shirt. Because I love you so. Now if my sky should fall, would you even call? I've opened up my heart, I never want to part. I'm giving you the ball.
You're tuned to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX 935. My topic tonight is young love, and I'm reading from a story written by Jordana Naran about a boy whom she loved but didn't really know who she was to him. They hadn't affixed a formal label of girlfriend, boyfriend, and she'd just been out to visit him. They'd had a lovely time, but she still didn't quite know where she stood, and she didn't feel good about it. The story continues. On the Saturday night train back to Manhattan, she cried. Back in her dorm room, buried under the covers so her roommates wouldn't hear, she fell asleep with a wet pillow and puffy eyes. The next morning, she awoke to a string of texts from him. "You get back okay? Let's do it again soon." And they did, meeting up for drinks in the city, spending the night at her place, neither of them daring to raise the subject of what they were doing or what they meant to each other. Naran kept telling herself she'd be fine. And she was. She is. But now it's more than 3 years after their first kiss, and more than a year after their first time. and she's still not over the possibility of him, the possibility of the two of them, and he has no idea. She says she's told her generation will be remembered for their callous commitments and rudimentary romances. We hook up, we sext, we swipe right. And all the while we avoid labels and try to bury our emotions. We aren't supposed to want anything serious. Not now, anyway. But a void is created when we refrain from telling it like it is, from allowing ourselves to feel how we feel. And in that unoccupied space, we're dangerously free to create our own realities. Her friend Shosh insists that she didn't actually have feelings for Jeremy. You don't know him anymore, she said. I think maybe you're addicted to the memories. In love with a person you've idealized who probably isn't real. And maybe she's right. Maybe my emotions are steeped in a past that never presented itself, Naren writes. Still, he enveloped her thoughts. She says, to this day, if I ever let a guy's name slip out to my father, his response is always, are you two going steady? He means to ask if we're dating exclusively, if I have a boyfriend. I used to hate it, she says. People don't go steady nowadays, she explained to her father. No one says that anymore, and almost no one does it. Women today have more power. We don't crave attachment to just one man. We keep our options open. We're in control. But are we? Naren asks herself. She's brooded over the same person for the last 4 years, so can she honestly call herself empowered? She's unable to share her feelings with him? Could her options be more closed? Could she be less in control? She says her father can't understand why she won't tell Jeremy how she feels. But to her, it's simple. As involved as they've been for what amounts to, at this point, nearly a quarter of her life, she and Jeremy are technically nothing, at least as far as labels are concerned. So while she teeters between anger with herself for not admitting how she feels and anger at him for not figuring it out, neither of them can be blamed. Or else they both can, she writes. Without labels to connect them, she has no justification for her feelings, and he has no obligation to acknowledge them. No labels, no drama, right? It's of Naren's opinion that her generation is venturing into some seriously uncharted waters, because while they're hesitant to label relationships, they do participate in some deviation of them. But by not calling someone, say, my boyfriend, that someone actually becomes something else, something indefinable. And what he and she have together becomes intangible. And if it's intangible, it can never end, because officially there's nothing to end. And if it never ends, there's no real closure, no opportunity to move on. Instead, she writes, we spend our emotional energy on someone we've built up and convinced ourselves we need. We fixate on a person who may not be right for us, simply because he never wronged us, because without a label, he never really had the chance. A Jeremy, her friend who'd coined the term, said, is the guy we never really dated, but never really got over. Naren writes, most people I know have a Jeremy in our lives. In years past, maybe back when people did go steady, he may have been the one who got away. But for her generation, he's the one they never had in the first place. Yet he's the one for whom they'd happily trade all the booty calls, hookups, and swiping rights. He's still the one they hope, against all odds, might be the one.
The stars have lost their glitter, the winds grow colder, suddenly you're older, and all because of the man that got away. Thank you.
has run off and undone you. That great beginning has seen a final inning. Don't know what happened. It's all a crazy game. Every trick of his, you're on to. But fools will be fools, and where's he gone to? The road gets rougher, it's lonelier and tougher. With hope, you burn up. Tomorrow he will turn up. There's just no let up. The livelong night and day. Ever since this world began, there is nothing sadder than a one-man woman looking for the man that got away.
And then there are the internet romances in this day and age. By the way, you're tuned to The Sharon Hour on Lagunas KX935. I'm Sharon James, and my topic tonight is young love. I've been reading stories that won a prize as best college essays in the New York Times. They're all related to young love. And this one is by Caitlin Dewey. She writes, "Curled up at the foot of my bed, my face inches from the laptop screen, I stared anxiously at the Google chat box. Quote, Will is typing, the box told me. I forced myself to read email while I waited for his message. Then I refreshed my Twitter feed, scrolled through my blog posts, and began brushing my teeth. Still, the box said, Will is typing. Don't you dare get hurt by this, she muttered to herself. This was a stupid idea, and you knew that from the start. But recognizing the stupidity of falling for someone on the internet doesn't actually prevent you from doing it. Dewey's friend Jeanette, a college radio DJ, chats constantly with some music blogger she met on Tumblr. And her friend Tuan, who lives in Los Angeles, stays up until after 3 to talk to his London-based girlfriend. And she had just driven nearly 1,100 miles round trip to visit Will, who was a guy she met in October at a web journalism conference and got to know almost entirely on Skype. She'd noticed him across the table at a noisy hotel bar, a man who owned sick black-framed glasses but no hairbrush or comb, traits, she said, that lent him the look of a basement-bound hacker. If you've ever attended an internet conference, she writes, you'd understand how pale skin, thick glasses and scruffy hair can be attractive. Otherwise, she can't explain it to you. In either case, she liked Will's weirdly overconfident smirk and his obsession with WordPress. He regaled her with the merits of plugins and PHP until she became tired and went to bed. I'll find you on Twitter, she joked when she left. And she didn't really expect or even want to see Will again after that weekend. Also, since he lived 3 states away, further FaceTime seemed unlikely. She followed his Twitter posts with detached curiosity, and in January he g-chatted her to complain about work. Then he got drunk and messaged her again, sometime near midnight. He wrote, with obvious sarcasm. Do you have that Skype thing kids talk about these days? 90% of human communication is nonverbal, Dewey says she'd read somewhere. And Skype captures that 90% on a low-resolution video camera, compresses it, funnels it to a node computer, and reproduces it on a screen anywhere in the world. Skype eliminates distance, and that's why it works. And that's exactly what it did for her and Will. With her Skype screen open and her webcam on, she viscerally felt that Will was sitting a foot away on her bed. Ignoring the times the picture froze or his voice cut out, she thought he looked and sounded exactly as he had in person. Sometimes when he leaned into the computer to read an article she'd sent him, she could actually see the pores of his face. And they started video chatting for hours every night. She learnt that he ate takeout for every meal, slept in a series of identical white V-neck T-shirts, and smirked with one side of his mouth when he said something clever. She knew his preferred coding languages, his least favourite content management system, and his general hatred of dancing, small talk, and girls in bars. One night, when they talked too late, she fell asleep with her laptop open and woke up 7 hours later, tangled in cords. And he was still there, asleep in the light from an open window, pale and young and pixelated. Eventually he stirred, blinked at the camera and said, "Hey, you." "Hey," she said back. "How did you sleep?" As the weeks went on, she told Will about her last boyfriend, a guy she'd met in psychology class and dated for almost 2 years. He listened quietly, his glasses reflecting her image from his computer, and gave good, clear-eyed advice about letting go. Dewey says she couldn't remember the last time she'd met somebody that smart and talented in ways she certainly wasn't. He told her about his ex-girlfriend, who never appreciated his work. And then she'd text him from classes when she was frustrated or bored. In the safety of her apartment, she could see Will, but she couldn't touch him. She could summon him when she wanted to talk, but she never knew him in any light other than the one from his bedside lamp. This phenomenon worked in her favour as well. She could call him after a few drinks, when she felt sufficiently talkative and social. At the same time, she could avoid him if she had videos to edit or blog posts to write. She could say whatever she wanted and risk awkwardness, because at the end of the conversation, one click of the mouse would shut him out of her room. The irony is that we flock to the internet for this type of safe, sanitized intimacy, Dewey writes. But in real life, IRL, in online parlance, we want something entirely different. At internet conferences, like the one where she met Will, Twitter explodes with people celebrating IRL meetings. The internet brings these people together with hashtags and message boards, but it never satisfies them. No matter how much you love someone's blog or Twitter feed, it isn't their posts you actually want. And so she says, slowly, cautiously, Will and she began circulating the question of what it all meant. "I really like you," he told her one night after getting home from the bar. "I really like you too," she said. "I don't know what that means." She wanted to find out. So in early March, she rented a car, begged her professors to let her out of class a day early, and drove 540 miles to spend a long weekend in the mid-sized city where Will lives. When she got close, she called her friend Tuan from a rest stop, where she fixed her makeup and chewed gum and generally tried to calm down. "What if it's terrible? What if he's nothing like I expect?" she wondered. In fact, Will was almost exactly as she expected. Thin lips, straight nose, small hazel eyes, glasses. He stood waiting at the side of the street while she parked her car, going forward and back, until she nervously got within 2 feet of the curb. And when she got out of the car, onto the cold, blustery sidewalk, as the wind whipped her thoughts around, they kissed.
Thank you.
Caitlin Dewey's guy didn't actually ask her to be his bride IRL in real life, and she wouldn't have said yes anyway. You're listening to Laguna's one and only KX93.5, a station that brings you music, chat, emergency alerts, fabulous car raffles, and musical events. And tonight, here on The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, it's bringing you young love stories from a competition the New York Times had on young love in the realm of college students. I'm currently in the middle of one by Caitlin Dewey. She met her love at an internet conference. They've been Skyping ever since, and she's just been to visit him for a weekend, which went quite well, except after they'd kissed and eaten pizza and gone back to his house, they struggled for things to talk about. In real life, Will stared off at nothing while she talked. In real life, he had no questions about the drive or her work or the stuff that waited for her when she went back to school. He took her out to dinner and read his email while they waited for their food. He apologized profusely but still checked his website traffic stats while they sat in his living room. He took her to a party at his friend's house, where he and his friend proceeded to argue for hours about web design while she sat on a futon and stared at the ceiling, drunk, bored, and terribly concerned that she looked thinner online. At various points, he grabbed her hand and gave her small, apologetic smiles, but it seemed like a strategy game, a constant dance of reaching for her and pulling back, of intimacy and distance, of real life and internet make-believe. On the last day of her visit, Will overslept, then rushed around the apartment with his hair wet and his tie untied, looking for his laptop. According to the plan they'd made the night before, he would go to work and she would leave when it suited her, dropping his spare keys in the mailbox. In the front hallway, where she stood rubbing her eyes, Will hugged her goodbye and told her to drive safely. He struggled for a closing statement, came up with, "It was great to see you." She said she didn't leave right away. After she showered and packed and studied the books near his fireplace, she sat for a long time at his kitchen counter, trying to work out what had happened. She didn't like being surrounded by his things. She felt more comfortable in her own room with her own things, with his presence confined to a laptop screen. She wrote him a note before she left. "Dear Will, thank you so much for having me this weekend. It meant a lot to me to spend time with you in person." She signed her name and left it on the counter.
If you go where the snowflakes fall, when rivers freeze and summer ends, please see for me if she's wearing a coat so warm to keep her from the howling winds. If you're traveling in the North Country Fair, where the winds hit heavy on the borderline, remember me, you are who lives there. She once was a true love of mine. If you're traveling in the North Country Fair, where the winds hit heavy on the borderline, remember me to the one who lives there. For she once was a true love of mine.
You are listening to The Sharon Hour on Laguna's KX93.5. I'm Sharon James, and my show tonight is about young love in a variety of forms. Here's one about sisterly love. It's written by Kylie Leddy, and it won first prize in a college essay contest that the New York Times put on. It starts, "Don't worry," reads the cover photo of my sister's Facebook page. "Everything's going to be amazing." Leddy writes, "The words in neon blue, green and red glow from the screen as a kind of preternatural promise, a message from beyond. When she's feeling stressed, she clicks on her sister's profile and gazes at that image. She says, people leave notes, messages, pictures on her page saying, I miss you, I love you, I'm thinking about you. In your flowers, they leave animated hearts. Sometimes they even respond to a comment of hers from years before, creating a certain kind of magic. Facebook preserves her sister's words, and her photos remain too, marking the various stages of her young life. You can view them chronologically, scrolling past a giggling girl in a pink Patagonia fleece to an 18-year-old model carrying a disposable camera and wearing a goofy smile. Her hair becomes gradually blonder, and her freckles scatter into constellations across her nose. You can see the seed of rebellion sprouting into an idea, her green eyes alive and wild, as her sister and her friend drive laughing through a toll gate with incorrect change. Lady writes, she used to call her sister's phone when she first disappeared. She knew her sister wouldn't answer. The signal had vanished the moment she had, but the voicemail was there, and she would dial her number just to hear her tell her to leave a message. Every so often she even did leave a message, or she would tell her about her day, or ask where she was. Other times she would just cry. She would text her sister's number too. She said technology allowing her to continue that casual correspondence, like a widower might speak to a gravestone. She said she kept her up with the Kardashians, told her what colleges she'd applied to, related gossip from their high school, and the details of their parents' separation. She told her crazy and ridiculous things, things you only tell your older sister. The messages were simply for comfort. Until one night, she writes, she was out with friends at an Irish pub in Boston, and she got a reply. She said, at that point it had been 2 years since the frigid January night, when her sister had taken a taxi to the foot of Philadelphia's Benjamin Franklin Bridge. 2 years since her parents sat with detectives, viewing security camera photos that showed her walking towards that bridge's high point in her red North Face jacket, and then not continuing on. 2 whole years since the searches for any trace of her had come up empty. And her family had never officially proclaimed her deceased. Still, the reality finally settled in, she said, like the dust that fell upon her untouched bedroom. So when Letty's iPhone buzzed at the bar in Boston and her sister's name appeared on the black screen, she was so startled that she dropped her phone. She was at that point a freshman in college and hadn't told her new friends about her sister. It was easier to say she was an only child rather than revealing the complicated truth. But that night, at that pub, a band had been playing her sister's favourite song. So she texted, "I miss you." And that's when her sister's name appeared with the message, "Who is this?" Letty writes that she rushed to the bathroom, collapsing onto a toilet seat, thinking, she's alive. Shaking, she pressed the call button. "Hello," a voice said, a female voice, but deeper than her sister's and older. And then the woman explained that she'd been given a number with her new cell plan. Her roommates found her sobbing in the store, mourning a new kind of loss. She says they guided her out past a well-meaning stranger who said, "Whoever he is, he's not worth the tears, trust me." She said she wanted to say, "He is a she, and trust me, she is worth it." She said she told her friends the truth that night, even though it's a truth she struggled to face herself. She says, "After all, if I could still see her, hear her, and text her, was she really gone? If Facebook could remind me annually of her birthday and calculate the passing years into her current age, then her death wasn't a period, not an end, but more of an ellipsis. She could still imagine the dot 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 of a chat bubble popping up at any moment." She writes, "When someone you love disappears, there's no finality of an autopsy report or the closure of a funeral. all you have is a lack of presence. You can piece together the mystery, like in the Nancy Drew books you used to devour, but there's no memorial service to confirm the truth. The promise of possibility, however faint, is harsher than any certainty. It's been 5 years now since her sister's disappearance, and Letty still fantasizes about an alternate outcome. That senseless hope is hard to smother, the off chance that some day she may see her face in a crowd, and she'll run towards her and save her this time.
It was you who was standing there. Tried, it was true, as your glance met my stare. But your heart drifted off like the landslip I see. I tried to go, to follow, to kneel down at your feet. I'll run, I'll run, I'll run, run to settling scores. I've been fighting so long, but I've lost your war, and our kingdom is gone. How shall I win back your heart, which was mine? I have broken bones, tattered clothes, I've run out of time. I'll run, I'll run, I'll run, run to
Several years ago, Letty's mother suggested they delete Letty's sister's Facebook account, wondering if it wasn't inappropriate the way her online life is paused with her random thoughts and photos and public display. In the end, though, they decided not to. It brings Letty too much comfort. She says as the years pass, she is now her sister's age when she disappeared. She says she's come to know her better from the quotes she posted in her bio, the songs she cued into her iPod, the comments she left on her friends' photos. She says it's like getting to know someone through glimpses in a window, but it's better than nothing. You're listening to The Sharon Hour. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's one and only KX93.5. My topic tonight is young love, and I'm reading a few stories from a competition the New York Times put out to college students, asking them to submit their experiences of young love. Some wrote full-length stories, others wrote little snippets. 100 words was the mandate. I'm going to read you a couple of those now. This one from Michelle Huang, who's studying at NYU. She writes, "It was Valentine's Day and I was his first girlfriend. He nervously asked if I wanted flowers. I jokingly answered that I'd rather have bacon. When I returned from class, he came bearing a bacon and chicken nugget bouquet." Fun, right? Then there's this one by Liana Wang. She's studying at Yale. She writes, "Through much of college, I avoided romance because I wanted more. More knowledge, more goals, always striving. Then," she says, "I fell for a close friend. The first morning I woke up to him, it was the first time I wanted less. Less work, less time committed to calendars, nothing more than this small, simple present."
Yeah.
Young Love is the topic of my share now tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. We take certain young loves for granted. The love of a parent for their newborn child, right? But if you were born in China at a certain point in history and were a girl, not a boy, and what's more, were a fourth-born girl, because four is an unlucky number in China, apart from being a failed option at a son, you could not take for granted the love of your male parent. Marie Lu writes this story, published amongst winning Asian stories in the New York Times. When she was born, her father, who had prayed every day to Guanyin for a son after three daughters, took one look at her and walked out of the birthing room. She subsequently spent her entire life hiding in corners, staying out of everyone's way, trying to make up for the ill fortune she had brought down upon her father. She tried to find little ways to organize his and her mother's lives around luckier numbers in order to divert calamities away from her family. She whispered to the rice plants to sprout in unison on the eighth day of spring. Eight bar sounded similar to far, the word for wealth and prosperity. Her father beamed at the bright green shoots blanketing the flooded fields and credited his luck to the auspicious timing. And when the hail came and rattled the tin roof of their house, she whispered for the storm to turn away in 3 hours. Sun, three, was similar to Zheng, the word for birth. Her father looked up in astonishment at the clearing skies and proclaimed that their stroke of luck had protected their crops. And when the rains dried up and the rice fields cracked, she whispered to the skies to send water within 9 days. Nine, dew, sounded like dew, the word for eternity and longevity. The skies opened and her father declared the family protected by the heavens. She, of course, never told anyone that she was responsible for these events in their lives. Being the fourth and a girl was misfortune enough. Adding the label of witch, Zhu, would surely ostracize their family from the rest of the village. She'd seen other girls accused of witchcraft, witnessed them excluded and left unmarried. One girl had been driven out of the village altogether. At night, she studied in secret by lantern light for the exams that could qualify her for a coveted government scholarship, one that sent students to study at American universities. That would give her a reason to leave home at last, to remove herself from this place altogether, and thus from the misfortune that came with her. But after she took the exams, the invitation that arrived in the mail came not from the government scholar fund, but from a society in Chicago that specialized in training students gifted with the kind of magic she possessed. How did they know? She spent that day studying her hands in wonder. The test had been as normal as she could have imagined. She didn't realize that her fingers had left trails of magic on the paper, like an imprint of dust that glittered long after she'd finished. So the next morning she woke up at Liu, six, which sounded similar to Liu, the word indicating clarity and smoothness, and she quietly left home, leaving the family's rural village to go to Shanghai, from where she would go to America. The entire trip on the boat, she practiced her talents, making broken light bulbs glow in the boat's dining area and forming patterns against the blue sky. The journey was surprisingly smooth. Other students in her bunker teased her country accent, asking where she came from. They were the children of wealthier families in the cities. She marvelled at their fur coats and cloche hats and the soft leather of their purses. Her own coat was old, the buttons twisted in the traditional Chinese sense, something that seemed old-fashioned beside these rich young women's Western fashions. When they got off the train in Chicago, finally, a photographer was waiting to take their photos. He said, for the paper. So they all clustered together in their best coats, their faces both eager and intimidated. She would never see the developed photo, but if she had, she'd have noted that her magic hung about her in a halo that the camera picked up. The lady waiting for her by the train platform was small, her back slightly rounded in a hunch, and when she stretched a hand out in greeting, her fingers were long and graceful. Welcome to Chicago, she said, and to your training in the art of magic. See, you've been blessed with great fortune. It was the first time anyone had ever looked pleased to see her. She said, I'm the fourth sister in my family, so I'm the bringer of misfortune. The Mandarin woman shook her head. That's impossible, you see, for I can tell that you've been gifted with the magic of luck. That's how your application somehow ended up at our office, and how I noticed the shimmer of magic on the paper. I will teach you how to wield it. The rice harvest, the diverted storm, the early rains, the smooth voyage, good fortune. It was the first time anyone had given her that identity, but she'd had it all along. What's that expression? Lucky in life, unlucky in love? We all know those people who seem to have the magic touch. Everything they touch turns to gold. But how do they fare in love, one wonders? Love, young love, is the topic of my sharing out tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, on Lunas KX 935. If only it worked the other way around as well. Unlucky in life, lucky in love. But it seems if you have it all, you have it all, and if you don't, you don't.
I make a date for golf, and you can bet your life it rains. I try to give a party, and the guy upstairs complains. I guess I'll go through life just catching colds and missing trains. Everything happens to me. I never miss a thing. I've had the measles and the mumps. And when I play an ace, my partner always trumps. I guess I'm just a fool who never looks before he jumps. Everything happens to me. At first my heart thought you could break this jinx for me, that love would turn the trick to in despair. But now I just can't fool his heart that thinks for me. I've mortgaged all my castles in the air. I've telegraphed and phoned and sent an airmail special to. Your answer was goodbye, and there was even postage due. I fell in love just once, and then it had to be with you. Everything happens to me.
Thank you.
I've telegraphed and phoned and sent an airmail special to. Your answer was goodbye, and there was even postage due. I fell in love just once, and then it had to be with you. Everything happens to me.
Well, that's about it for my share in hour tonight. That's for me, Sharon James, on KX93.5, Laguna's one and only FM public, listener-supported, member-supported radio station. If you would like to hear this show again, it does podcast either via iTunes or on our website, kx935.com, which we'd love you to visit in all events to hopefully become a member. We need your patronage. You'll also be able to find out there about the special raffle we have going and other musical events and the lineup of all our shows. For this particular show, the link to my podcast is kx935.com/shows/the-sharon-hour. That's sharing without the G, a pun on my name, hour with the H. Meantime, this is Sharon James saying go in love, and I do hope you'll come back and listen to more Sharon Hours on more and diverse topics every Monday night at 9 p.m.